Amen. Good morning. Happy Father's Day. And also to you. Well, thank you. That's a vote of confidence. I'm not a father yet, but someday. I was listening this week. I listened back to an old Dylan song. We got Dylan fans here, I assume. Bob, of course, not Jacob. Not that Jacob's bad. Jacob's fine, you know, but I was listening to his song, My Back Pages, if you're familiar with that one. It's an old one, you know, but it's just one of these songs where he showcases his lyrical brilliance. And one of the things that's interesting about it is Dylan is talking about this time in his life where he knew it all. He had everything figured out. He thought he had all the answers to life's questions kind of hammered down. And then as he gets to the end of each stanza, he adds this two-line addendum that kind of subverts the supposed wisdom that he'd been carrying with him at that time. It's where he says, "But I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now." We know this song? Quick example here. A self-ordained professor's tongue, too serious to fool, spouted out that liberty is just equality in school. Equality, I spoke the word as if a wedding vow. What a great line. But I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. And as I was listening to Eric speak this last week, talking about the life upon life upon life that God is inviting us into through the person of Jesus Christ, it occurred to me, this Dylan line kind of came back to me, and it occurred to me that that attitude, that posture should really characterize the life of someone who's a follower of Jesus, that we should come to a place in our lives as we grow, as we mature and develop, where we're able to look back and say, you know, I used to take myself so seriously. I used to think everything depended on me. I used to expect perfection from myself and other people. I would get so anxious and bent out of shape about so many things. I used to let my work or my performance define my identity. I used to think that I had everything figured out. I used to be so wise, but I was so much older then, right? And this is an idea that Jesus is pointing to in Mark chapter 10 when he says to his disciples at one point, "Truly I tell you, anyone who will not receive the kingdom of God like a little child will never enter it." It's this moment in Jesus' ministry where people are trying to bring their children to Jesus so he can put his hand on them and bless them. And the disciples apparently think Jesus has more important things to do. And so they're trying to prevent people from doing that. And it says Jesus becomes indignant. And he says to him, "Do you not realize that the kingdom belongs to such as these?" In other words, do you not realize these are your exemplars in many ways? "Truly, I tell you." And what he's trying to get his disciples to understand, he's saying to them, "Listen, guys, if you're going to be a follower of mine in this life, and part of that is going to mean growing up, becoming more adult in a whole host of different ways, but part of that is going to mean becoming younger in a whole host of different ways," right? To receive the kingdom, if you want to enter the kingdom now, you have to become like children. And what Jesus isn't saying is that children are perfect. You know, he's not saying if you want to receive the kingdom, then become gullible like a little child, right? If you want to receive the kingdom, just throw a tantrum until you get what you want. He's not saying become childish, of course. But what he is saying is this: full maturity as a human being. Full maturity means becoming childlike in some respects. And so the question becomes, what do they have that I don't? You know, what have I grown out of inadvertently over the years that I need to grow back into with a vengeance if I'm going to open myself to the invitation Jesus is offering someone like me in this life to experience that life upon life upon life? And I want to suggest that at least part of what it means for us to open ourselves to that kind of life is that we would develop this extraordinary or unusual capacity for wonder. That we would develop this deep-seated ability to stand in awe of the world around us, and by extension, obviously, to stand in awe of the one who made it all. And I think this matters. Why? Because wonder is the fuel of worship. Wonder is really where worship begins. Wonder is that thing that allows us to stand before God without domesticating God. You with me? With our own limited imagination, our own sense of what's possible, myopic sense of what's possible, wonder is what allows us to perceive the world around us, to perceive the miracle of our own life, not just as this collection of random materials, not just as nature, but as creation. as the created work of a good God who is way, way beyond our understanding. Wonder wakes us up to that God. Wonder teaches us to stand before that God and to say, wow, there is nothing, there is no one like you. Just isn't. Wonder wakes us up to the miracle of our own life. Does it not? Part of opening ourselves to the kingdom now in this life means opening ourselves to this thing called wonder. And Eric, as he was talking last week, mentioned Gerard Manley Hopkins, the poet. Hopkins, in my view, is one of these people who embodied this sense of childlike wonder in a way very few people have in history. Hopkins was a Catholic priest and a poet. He lived in the late 1800s in England. And Hopkins, a lot of times, would go on these walks through the English countryside, just over an afternoon, go on these long walks, and he would try and watch for the way God's glory was going to reveal itself in the mundane. And then he would come back, and he would record in his journal, sometimes pages and pages in his journal, of observations that he had made while he was out on his walk. Sometimes he'd devote a whole paragraph to something like a tree. Just the texture, the color of the bark on the tree, the way the branches bent and all these different angles, at these different angles, the leaves, what the leaves looked like, their color, the way the tree was arranged against the backdrop of the sky. And it's out of those experiences that Hopkins wrote, we assume, some of his most famous poems, one of which starts with this line, you probably know it, the world is charged, as in electricity, the world is charged with the grandeur of God. In other words, you just don't have to look that far to see it, because it permeates everything. Psalm 111 says it like this. How amazing are the deeds of the Lord. All who delight in him should ponder them. That's an easy sentence to skip past, in my view. But listen to what it's saying there. It's saying basically, become like Hopkins. All who delight in him, in God, should ponder what he does. Why? Because everything he does reveals his glory and majesty. Everything. And so as we consider this morning this idea of wonder, I want to talk more specifically, if I may, about wonder at creation itself, at plants and trees and, you know, birds and fish and water and sky and sun and dirt and wind and whatever else. Because here's what I think. In my own experience, I think this is true for many people I know. It's in nature. It's in God's creation, the physical world around us, that God's glory is almost always immediately available to us and where it is often the most dramatically neglected. You with me? God's glory in creation itself, it's where God's glory is almost always immediately available to our senses. It's just right in our face, and it's where it is often the most quickly, immediately dismissed, overlooked, or neglected. I mean, that's certainly the case in my own life. It's funny, honestly, for me to even be talking about this stuff, sharing about it with you all, because you can ask friends of mine. Historically, I am not a nature lover. I'm not a particularly outdoorsy person. You know, I would rather stay in a hotel room than a tent. More often than not, I'd rather drive up a mountain than hike. You know, I don't even have one of those metal carabiner things to put my keys on. It's just not how I roll. But I was thinking back over my life, and I was remembering that even for me, it wasn't always like that. You know, there was a time in my life where I was just kind of enthralled to God's creation. I would go outside. I'd come in at night having been outside, and I'd have grass in my hair, you know, and like grass stains and scrapes from where I'd been climbing trees and whatever else. And I was thinking about the way that I used to just like really be in awe of the world God had made. If there were bugs, I would get down on my knees, you know, and try and inspect what kind of a bug it was. If it was in my house, I'd pick it up with my hands and take it outside and release it. You know? Today, if there's a bug in my house, I step on it. I go get a paper towel or tissues or something. I pick it up so I don't even really have to see it, and I flush it down the toilet. Burial at sea, you know? There was a time when I would get down on my knees in reverence at like the smallest creatures in creation, and now I crush them. And what happened? I could say what happened is, you know, I grew up, you know. I matured, I moved on, but I'm not sure that's the whole story. I think at least part of the story is that somewhere along the line, I got bored. You with me? like somewhere along the line, I started walking outside and I was like, okay, trees, I've seen trees before and grass, and okay, that's fine, I guess. And there's some birds, I've seen those, and squirrels, and it's like, do something new. You know, I'm done with it. I'm moving on. I've got other things to worry about. And I probably wouldn't have given that a second thought, honestly, my whole life long, but I started reading this guy, G.K. Chesterton, his book, Orthodoxy. Anyone read Orthodoxy? I'd recommend it. It's a pretty brilliant book. Chesterton makes this suggestion, makes this argument that for a human being to be bored by repetition is not so much a sign of maturity as it's a sign of weakness. He says to be bored by repetition or monotony or something that we've experienced before is not as much a sign of maturity, of growing up, as it is a sign of weakness. And he argues that if we're going to cultivate this kind of childlike spirit in a good way, that it's going to require us to relearn how to exult in things, even though we've experienced those things countless times in our past. And so he points out the favorite phrase of a kid. He says, you know what a child's favorite phrase is? It's the phrase, do it again. Because, you know, you pick up a kid and swing it around and they say, did I just call the kid it there? Swing the child around and they say, do it again, right? And so you do it again. They say, do it again. And you just keep going over and over and over again. And you get to the point where you're borderline exhausted. And they know you're exhausted because just as you're about to quit, they switch from do it again to one more time. Right? Just one more time. And so you just keep doing it over and over and over again. And Chesterton says there's something in that phrase, do it again, that just suggests this insatiable, almost eternal appetite resident within a child, and this ability to delight in things even when they're repetitive. And then he makes this brilliant turn. He asks this question, could it be that when it comes to the natural world, the world we inhabit, could it be that God is in fact the same way? Could it be that when it comes to the physical world, God is more childlike than we would anticipate? Follow his logic here. He says, we don't have this up on the screen, listen to this. He says, because children are in spirit fierce and free, therefore they want things repeated and unchanged. They always say, do it again, and the grown-up person does it again until he's nearly dead, for grown-up people are not strong enough to exult in monotony. And here's the turn. But perhaps God is strong enough to exult in monotony. It's possible that God says every morning, do it again to the sun, and every evening, do it again to the moon. It may not be automatic necessity. By the way, the Psalms bear that out, that God commands the sun to rise every morning, commands the moon to appear in the evening, right? He says it's possible that God is saying, do it again, over and over. It may be that God makes every daisy separately, but has never got tired of making them, he says. And then he diagnoses our condition for us. It's this brilliant line. He says, for we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. Isn't that awesome? For we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. In other words, for you and I to become apathetic at something that is essentially a miracle, even if that miracle is repeated over and over and over again, it's not a sign of maturity. It's a sign of something else. It's a sign of weakness. And it's weakness that I think people have been contending with for a long time. You know, if you go read through the Old Testament, you see it pretty quickly. You know one of God's primary complaints with the people of Israel in the Old Testament? It's that time and time again, day in, day out, year after year, God demonstrated to them his power and wisdom and beauty and goodness. And day in, day out, year after year, Israel remained basically unimpressed. So you can go read through the book of Exodus. You know, Psalm 78 actually encapsulates it really well. Israel's in captivity. They cry out to God. God hears their cry. He delivers them through this miraculous series of events. They begin to flee across the desert. Pharaoh's army is bearing down on them. They're caught up against the Red Sea, and they turn to Moses and say, why did you even bring us out here? Did you just bring us out here to kill us off finally? But God intervenes, right? And he parts the waters. They walk through as if on dry ground. They turn around to see Pharaoh's army swept into the water as the walls converge, right? And then God begins to lead them across the desert. He gives them a pillar of cloud during the day and a pillar of fire at night. Do you notice, by the way, how blasé that's become to us as I say that? You notice how in your brain you're like, yeah, cloud, fire, I got that. You know, it's fine. I've heard it. It's good. A pillar of cloud by day? That's how we're going to do this? Going across the desert, fire by night? Why cloud during the day? Well, it gets really hot in the desert during the day, doesn't it? So wouldn't we need maybe some cloud cover? And why fire at night? Well, it gets really cold in the desert at night, does it not? And really dark. So that's kind of brilliant. God causes water to come out of a rock, not a rock, a rock, so that they aren't thirsty. Causes bread to fall down from heaven so they aren't hungry, right? But Israel wants meat, and they say to Moses, what are we doing out here? You know, we had it better back in Egypt. Seriously, man. And it says God's anger burned against them. Why? Because over and over and over again, he revealed to them his faithfulness, his ability to care for them. And over and over and over again, they lapsed into complacency. They turned their heads. It's interesting, you go read through the book of Job. I don't know if you're familiar with that book, but if you are, you know that Job had to negotiate this incredible series of tragedies in his life. Like, he really had some difficult things befall him. And it comes to a point in the narrative where Job is pretty much fed up. He's at his wit's end, and he's trying to argue his case before his friends and before heaven, and he's insisting on his innocence. He's insisting he has not done anything to deserve all of the horrible things he's had to suffer. And finally, when God reveals himself to Job, arrives on the scene, it says God comes, it's at the beginning of chapter 38, and speaks to Job through a storm. And says, it's really interesting, you notice that God doesn't provide Job. If you read through those chapters, you realize God doesn't give Job any theological rationale for why he's experiencing the things he's experiencing. He doesn't say, well, Job, here's the deal, because A equals B and B equals C, you know, this had to happen so that my glory would be revealed and there would be a book in the Bible that people could read, you know? He doesn't go through these mental gymnastics with Job. You know what he says? You see this whole world that I've made? You see all of my creation? What part did you play in that? Listen to how God puts it. It says, then the Lord answered Job from the whirlwind. Who is this that questions my wisdom with such ignorant words? Brace yourself. One translation says it, brace yourself like a fighter, which is great. Brace yourself because I have some questions for you. And then he just kind of goes off for a minute. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you know so much. Do you know how its dimensions were determined and who did the surveying? What supports its foundations and who laid its cornerstone as the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy? And God is just getting warmed up here. If you know the passage, I'm just giving you an excerpt here of some of the questions God has for Job. He's about to go on a rampage. Who defined the boundaries of the sea as it burst from the womb and as I clothed it with clouds and thick darkness? Have you ever commanded the morning to appear and caused the dawn to rise in the east? Have you explored the springs from which the seas come? Have you walked about and explored their depths? Where does the light come from and where does the darkness go? Have you visited the treasuries of the snow? Have you seen where the hail is made and stored? Can you hold back the movement of the stars? Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Have you watched as the wild deer are born? Do you know how many months they carry their young, and are you aware of the time of their delivery? Will the wild ox consent to be tamed? Will it plow a field for you? Can you rely on it to return, bringing your grain to the threshing floor? Do you hear all of the nature imagery? You hear all the stuff that God is really fired up about? He says, look at the ostrich, the horse, the hawk, the eagle. Take a look at the mighty hippopotamus, God says. I made it just as I made you. That's a line. Can you catch a crocodile with a hook or put a noose around its jaw? Will it beg you for mercy or implore you for pity? I mean, God's fired up. This is my favorite passage, actually. The ostrich section, if you know it. He says, look at the ostrich. She lays her eggs on top of the earth, letting them be warmed in the dust. She doesn't worry that a foot might crush them or that wild animals might destroy them. She is harsh toward her young. She's unconcerned, though they die. Why? For God has deprived her of wisdom. he has given her no understanding. It's God's PC way of saying, you see that bird? That bird is dumb. You wish you could make a bird that dumb. But, next sentence, but whenever she jumps up to run, she passes the swiftest horse with its rider. Think that bird looks foolish? Try and take it on in a race. You'll see who looks foolish. You will not believe it, God says. You know, Job wants all these answers to his questions, and God is just like, have you even been paying attention? Do you have any sense of the kind of artist that is at work in this world? Do you understand the kind of wisdom that I possess? And then we come to this part, I love this moment, when Job finally responds. God has gone on his whole rampage diatribe thing, and God finishes speaking, and it says Job's response is that he becomes completely silent, and he puts his hand over his mouth. What's that a picture of? Check it out here. Then Job replied to the Lord, I am nothing. How could I ever find the answers? I will put my hand over my mouth in silence. I've said too much already. I have nothing more to say. What's it a picture of? I think it's a picture of a man who's captivated by awe, a wonder for the first time in a long time, right? Who realizes I've been so fixated on my own personal circumstances that I've just become totally numb to the work of God all around me. It's like I've become sedated due to overexposure. I have sinned and grown old, and my father is younger than me. And as I've been thinking for myself and for the rest of us, what is it that causes us, that keeps us from responding to God's creation the way Job responds? It's occurred to me that, you know, it might be a little bit more difficult for us these days because compared to Job's time, we live in an age of relative sophistication when it comes to our knowledge of the natural world. You with me? Meaning we have answers to some of the questions God poses. Think about this. Have you explored the springs from which the seas come? Well, sure, we've been there. Have you visited the treasuries of the snow? Have you seen where the hail is made and stored? Well, yeah. Have you seen the Weather Channel? Well, we get it, God. You know, high, low pressure systems, isobars, whatever. And by the way, we have planes that go through the clouds, so we've been to where the hail is made and stored. Look at the ostrich, the horse, the hawk, the eagle, God says, and we say, yeah, we have. They're in our zoos. Can you catch a crocodile with a hook or put a noose around its jaw? Well, we used to because we had a guy called the Crocodile Hunter, right? Well, he went away. Of course, what I'm not saying is that we don't still have questions. We don't still have things to investigate and understand. I think even today we have way more questions about the physical world than we do have answers, right? But what I am saying is this, that one of the byproducts of gaining mastery over our environment is that a lot of us over time have lost the ability to experience something that is essentially miraculous and to be able to stand there dumbstruck, speechless, with our hand over our mouth. And if I'm saying anything this morning, I think I'm just saying that we aren't off the hook, you know? We may have fortressed ourselves off in our cities and our neighborhoods. We may have, you know, protected ourselves from the elements. We may have controlled our climate. We may have traced the migratory patterns. We may have predicted the seasons. We may have exploited the earth's resources. We may have trapped and killed and dissected or made pets of the world's fiercest creatures. We may have done all of that stuff. We may know a little bit more about how the world works, but we are not off the hook as the people of God when it comes to seeing and responding to the work that God is doing in this world every second of every minute of every day. We just aren't off the hook for that. Why? Because the world is still charged. It's still chock full of his presence. It's still filled with the grandeur of God. Annie Dillard says it like this. Look, in short, at practically anything. The mantis's face, a banana, the human ear, and see that not only did the Creator create everything, but that he is apt to create anything, he'll stop at nothing. She was also the one who said at some point, we don't have it on the slide, but she said, beauty and grace are going to be performed in this world whether we see it or not. The least we can do is try to be there. Try to be present to it as we encounter it in the world. And so I've been trying over the last few months, really over the last few years, if I'm honest, to try and reorient myself a little bit, to try and see with new eyes beauty and grace as it's being performed in front of me. And I just made a quick list this week of a few of the things I've experienced over the last while. And I just thought I'd share just a small handful with you. Moments where I've seen or got to experience God's grandeur in the world around us. I was walking with a professor at Ohio State 2 years ago now. It was at the end of a term, late in the afternoon, and it was drizzling, and we were walking across the campus, the big oval part of the campus with all of the grass and, you know, open field area. And we're walking along, and we're having this pretty involved conversation. We have our umbrellas, and we're really engaged. And at some point, he's in the middle of a sentence, and he kind of turns his head. And before I know it, he's stopped dead in his tracks, and he's turned with his whole body, and he's just looking across the field. And so I stop, and I'm like, okay, what's... And he says, look at that tree. He's standing there with his whole body face, and I look, and it's like 70 or 80 yards across the field is this chestnut tree in bloom, the only one in the oval. He says, look at that tree. And so we just stop for like 30 seconds. Didn't say anything. And I remember thinking, like it was a moment for me, I remember thinking, this is what it's like to really see the world. He's teaching me right now what it's like. I think about the guest house I was staying in North Carolina this last semester and how at night I'd come out and occasionally out of the brush in the corner of the property near the creek, out of the trees and bushes, a fox would come out. I named it Fleet. And Fleet would sometimes come out, and then like the second or third time I saw it, I realized Fleet had kids, little baby foxes. I don't know what those are called, smaller foxes. And so they would come out of the trees, and she would start to like make her way across the parking lot down along the creek, and the little foxes would follow her, right? Three or four of them. And occasionally one would stop and like look up at me, you know? And I was just like, that's freaking amazing. There's foxes living right here. I thought this was my house. They're like, what are you doing here? I went to coffee with a friend a couple years ago at Latte Land on 75th Street. I come out of the coffee shop, and there are these pigeons in the air, 50 or 60 of them, and they're making this big circle, and it's just like this perfect circumscribed thing in the air. They aren't running into each other at all, and as I'm watching them, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they switch directions. They go from going counterclockwise to clockwise without running into each other at all. It's a perfect formation, and I'm sitting there going, I was in marching band. I know how hard that is. We would work for weeks to try and get that synchronized, and they're just pigeons. You know, they're just hanging out in the city, just doing their thing. Or I went to the Nelson, this is a few years back now. I was at the Nelson this morning, though, so it made me think of this experience that I was going to go, you know, look at the art, but as I arrived and I was walking through that little backyard area of the Nelson, and I started walking up these steps, and I walked past this bush that had all of these little berries on it, and the bush had all these clusters of berries. Each cluster had five or six of them, and as I walked past, I realized, there's five or six berries on each of these clusters, and they are all distinctly different colors. Like one's bright red, and one's dark maroon and purple and fuchsia, and I'm sitting there going, these get the same nutrients, the same light. Like, how is that possible? It's incredible. And then I walk up the stairs a little bit more and start to turn and make my way like toward the entrance. And I get to the point where there are these trees that have lost their leaves. I think it was autumn. It must have been. They lost their leaves. And they're aspen trees. Do those even live here? Do those aspen trees, that's possible? Thank you. They've lost all their leaves, and each leaf, they've covered the entire lawn, this whole corridor of about 20 feet of the lawn. They've completely blanketed it. And they're bright fluorescent yellow. It's like someone has come along with a spray paint can and sprayed each of them a uniform yellow. And it was just incredible. No leaves on the trees up here, all of them on the ground. It was like this huge flower just lost its petals on the lawn. It's just like, wow. And then I go up into the Nelson and I walk in and the attendant says, "You can't bring your coffee in here, you need to leave it there." I'm like, all right. I drink my coffee and throw it away, and then I start making my way through the museum, but it's Saturday, and so there's a lot of people there, and it's kind of loud because people don't understand museum etiquette, so I'm trying to move away from the crowd so I can enjoy the artwork, but then there are the guards there, and they're looking at me kind of suspiciously because, you know, there's that buffer zone. They don't want you to get too close to the work. And so I get to this point where I'm just looking for some place to enjoy the art, and it occurs to me in the moment, the best, the most impressive art exhibit that the Nelson has on display today is outside its doors in the backyard. It is the only art exhibit composed entirely of living organisms. It has the most astonishing creative genius. It demonstrates the most profound vitality and life and brilliance. There are no guards. There are no crowds. There's no hours of operation. There's no cost. There's nothing. You can just go and experience it whenever you want. And you can take your coffee anywhere. It's the only art exhibit that is going to replenish itself. Every year, it's going to put on a new show for us, whether we see it or not. And we're just blowing past it on our way inside. Or then you start reading. And, you know, this is just endless. You can do this forever, but I'll just share a couple things I stumbled across lately. I was reading a book on oranges a couple weeks ago. Don't ask me why. I came across this fact that we're talking about citrus trees and the fact that you can grow different kinds of fruit on one citrus tree if you engineer it properly. It says this: a single citrus can be turned into a carnival with lemons, limes, grapefruits, tangerines, kumquats, and oranges all ripening on its branches at the same time. You can grow a fruit salad on one tree if you need to. There are 228 separate and distinct muscles in the head of an ordinary caterpillar. 228 separate and distinct muscles in the head of a caterpillar. That makes sense. Oh, this is interesting. This came out a couple years ago. You may remember this, but people have been studying mice forever, right? And scientists have been studying the mating habits of mice, and they discovered fairly recently that when a male mouse catches the scent of a female, it sings. Up until this point, we thought that only birds, whales, and a human being sang to communicate, right? And now apparently mice do too, and the issue has been that it was at such high frequencies that it was inaudible to the human ear. But now scientists, using translation technology, have been able to record sounds that we can hear. Check it out. Here's the best part. Who knew? Or this. We have all of these in our neighborhoods. These grew on trees outside my apartment in Ohio. They grow near your house, I'm sure. It's called a maple key. And every spring, you know, thousands of these things just come off the trees in all our neighborhoods, you know, everywhere that we live, and they come off the trees like this. That's freaking incredible. Do you agree? Should we do that one more time just for fun? Do it again, as they say? Let's try and get it out here a little bit farther. All right. I mean, what on earth? Why wouldn't we just have something like this just drop into the ground like most seeds, you know? They're just hanging out, doing their thing in all these neighborhoods and all the cities that we live in the Midwest, and just occasionally when it comes spring, on a certain day, hundreds of thousands of them will just float down. And few people, if any, are paying any attention to that. wow. All you have to do is watch. All you have to do is watch. I was reading a theologian this week named Jürgen Moltmann, a German theologian, and he says, here's the beautiful thing about being a person. He says, part of being a human being created in the image of God is that we are Eucharistic beings, meaning we have been made to give thanks to the Creator. And moreover, we have been designated, given the privilege of standing before creation, who's already worshiping God in all sorts of ways, standing before creation and articulating to God the praise of all creation. He talks about loosening the dumb tongue of nature. He says, we are the ones who get to stand at the front of the crowd, so to speak, and say to God, there is no one like you. O creatures of our God and King, lift up your voice and let us sing, praise him. That's one of the responsibilities that we have in this world. And you know, sometimes we talk about how to have an encounter with God. God has to reveal himself so that we might respond, right? And of course, while that is true, one of the things we sometimes forget is that God's glory is revealed in the world all around us. And for us to walk through our lives with our five senses intact and to remain basically unimpressed is not a failure of revelation in any respect. It's a failure, a tragic failure of response on the part of God's people. It's a failure to behold the beauty and the wisdom of God that is staring us in the face day after day after day. For you and I, today, if we're looking for a reason to worship, for the most part, we don't need any new revelation. We just need to open our eyes. You with me? And so I was sweeping off my porch once of an apartment, and I had a push broom that I just bought at a garage sale, and I was trying it out. And my apartment was on the third floor. It was like 50 feet above the ground. And as I was sweeping, I got to the edge, and I swept like really hard, you know, and pushed all of this junk off of the porch. And what I didn't realize is that my porch had been inhabited by like 100 maple keys. And so I push, and I look over the edge, and all of a sudden, there's 50 or 60 of these things just twirling all over the place in all these different directions, just going everywhere. And I was speechless. And a few seconds later, I found myself on the porch saying out loud, under my breath, quietly, I found myself saying, God, there is nothing like you in this world. I don't even have words to describe what you must be like. All you got to do is watch. And here's why, because watching, when you do it well, watching leads to wonder, which leads to worship, which leads to more watching. And leads to more wonder and more worship until one day you see it. One day you wake up in the morning and you realize this whole world is in fact charged with the grandeur of God. And you go outside, and not to sound silly about it, but you go outside and you're going to notice all the blades of grass pointing their finger up in the air at the one who made them. You're going to see the trees standing there with their arms stretched out to their creator. You're going to hear birds singing in chorus or parading in this stunning formation before their king. You're going to wake up and you're going to see it. You're going to have new eyes. And then you're going to think back to the time in your life when you just used to walk through the world like a zombie, as we all do sometimes, just numb to everything around you, not noticing anything, not even seeing the goodness, the glory of God's creation. You're going to think back to that time and you're going to think, you know, I was so much older then. I'm younger than that now. Amen? Let's pray. It's true that we can look at practically anything. And I confess to you, God, that I have spent so much of my life oblivious to the work that you're doing around me. I confess that I am so often like Job, just totally fixated on my own life circumstances, frustrated, and I allow my frustrations to eclipse the good work that you're doing. I allow my life to distract me from acknowledging the sheer genius that's resident within you. And I just want to become more childlike. I want to become someone who knows how to practice wonder, who knows how to stand in awe, who knows when to be silent with my hand over my mouth. I pray that you would teach us how to do that. Give us that capacity as your people. You are worthy of that kind of praise. We pray these things together in your name. Amen.